I knew we were in trouble this afternoon when we were on, I mean this morning when we were on the boat. If people start acting out already on Tuesday when you're on the way in, you really got something to hand. So I'm with
you.
What
about you two?
Don't count yourself out of the bus.
This is being recorded.
Anyway, I'd like to introduce Eldon Olson. Eldon Olson is the Director of Consultation to Clergy. Consultation to Clergy is the is a direct link to my office and to the Office of the Bishops of the ELCA Synod in the Northwest, the five synods in the geographical area that comprises Alaska, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We have a committee that meets, and two of the bishops, myself, and some lay representation, a health professional, and a teacher, a DCE-type person, are the committee. And you should know, especially the families that are represented here, that consultation to clergy is a service available to pastors and their families as you feel need to call and direct your need to Dr. Olson apart from our offices or through our offices, in whether it's emotional or personal or career evaluation or whatever, to utilize this service. I have been more than pleased of the help that Eldon Olson has brought to our church in this district since he has come aboard. Third year now?
Into the fourth.
Mm-hmm. I'm losing count. And the model that we adopted at the time when he came aboard is that he does a lot of referral, but he does the initial in service contact and carries some of the people as service in pastoral care and in specialization, and also does these kinds of things in the church, and that's a central way of us to have additional service. The subject that we're dealing with is a subject that has kind of grown out of our working together, the responsibilities that I have and the bishops have and that he deals with. And there's really two tracks to it. One is that these kinds of presentations at the conferences, and this is the second conference he's doing it in our synod. And the second track was just being introduced, and you received a letter in your congregations and your pastor, your chairman, and you as pastors, in which I'm gathering additional people who will be trained in terms of helping you to recognize some of the places in which you really need to be sensitive as pastors in this area of sexuality and dealing with sexual situations and ethics. So I'm looking forward. I didn't hear the last time around. I'm looking forward for Eldon to do this. And Eldon is came to us from Montana as a continuing education, whatever the official title is. Mm-hmm. Counterpart. We don't have a counterpart. Oh, yeah, Walt Pilgrim would be the counterpart. And but he's also very much trained in the area of counseling and service to people, and has a very strong sensitivity, and I'm really delighted that he's with us and helping us again. Eldon, go ahead.
And, thank you.
We're pleased with your service.
I'm supposed to start this by saying who I am, and I'm Eldon Olson, and this is session one of three. Good to be back. I was with you, I think, 2 years ago and did some things on Pastor as Wounded Healer in the Coeur d'Alene area. And in fact, I was with you 3 years ago here. And I think it was about the first place I came as I was entering this job. Am I audible? That's a real issue with me late at night sometimes. I don't
visuals
always project.
Huh? The visual's a little distorted.
Yeah, that's all right. I don't care. Good to be here. I intend these sessions to be conversations, and not. I was introduced as the speaker. I want to be that. Make that as very loosely applied as possible, because I'd like your responses and reflections. I value them very much. I greet you with the Easter greeting, Christ is risen.
He is risen indeed.
Hallelujah.
The topic that was suggested to me is a little different from the one, in fact, the art that I had done before in Idaho with the pastor's conference, but it was Bill Shimkus that defined it, and that was the pastor's relationship to women, for women and with women. I have done some little different things than I had done before because I want to focus more specifically, partly in response to some continuing education opportunities that I've recently had, and partly in response to the fact that we begin with 1990 with the decade of solidarity with women. Traditional treatments of the whole subject of sexuality have usually taken the whole kind of a theological and an ethical posture. Theological posture from the standpoint of saying that sexuality is God's gracious gift, that being created as men or as women or as women or as men has given to us an enormously vital, precious, and kind of indelible sense of our identity. To be human is to be sexual. Quite simply, it's unimaginable that a person would claim the dimensions of being human in any biblical context without also claiming the dimensions of being graciously sexual. And I suggest that as kind of the primary theological motif. Let me just sort of reflect on that for a minute and invite your reflections as well. It has seemed to me that in the whole understanding of ourselves as sexual persons, it is with that we have a profound sense of self-worth. Whatever we may say about original sin, whatever we may say about human nature, the creation of the human being as a sexual person, as women or as men, gives us our sense of value. I have never met a person who had significant sexual problems who also did not have a considerable diminished sense of personal value. The two are almost always associated. To have a sense of oneself as sexual is to know oneself as significant human being, intimately, uniquely, preciously, kind of autonomously. It's a sense of one's own self-worth. It's a sense of one's effectiveness as a human being. It's a sense of one's own ability to grasp the process of maturation. To know oneself as sexually created is to know that I grow and that I change, and that I move from being a child or an infant to being a woman or a man. To know oneself as sexual and of sexual valuing is, therefore, probably the most holistic of all definitions of one's sense of value. Because it is in one's sexuality that one integrates one's faculties of the mind, one's faculties of the emotions, one's faculties of the human flesh. It's comprehensive sense of self. Secondly, theologically, we may define sexuality as God's gracious gift, because in and through sexuality, in countless ways, we attain intimacy. We attain relationship. Sexuality is that which provides us with relational intensity.
just as it is hard to imagine a human identity which is not sexually defined, it is also hard to imagine a human relationship which is not in some way defined by the dynamics of our sexuality. Persons who are relationally incapacitated, wounded, are invariably persons whose wounds reach to their sexuality. Sexuality is the relational intensifier of the human. You just can't imagine, just whether it's the politeness of a hello to a stranger or the intimacy of a relationship of love, it's hard to imagine a human relatedness without the dimension of being a woman or being a man, without the dimension of being a sexual human being. It again is that point where we engage all of what we are as human beings in relationships with another person. Sexually unhealthy persons invariably not only have lousy self-image, but they also have great difficulties attaining and establishing and maintaining human intimacy. It's really hard to be intimate with a human being if one doesn't know and understand the dynamics of one's own sexuality. Thirdly, from a theological standpoint, we could define sexuality in terms of procreation. This is the Thomistic definition, the definition with which we have spent so much time in Christian tradition. Sexuality defined primarily within a marriage relationship in which the possibility, the potentiality of children, of reproduction exists, genital sexual relationships. It is out of that most of our ethical reflection, that dimension of sexuality has provided most of our ethical reflection on human sexuality. I'd like to broaden the scope a bit this evening and in the context of this time we spend together this week, or rather redefine that scope a little bit. And let me move slowly into that. The other traditional way we've defined sexuality is not only in terms of its theological doctrine of creation, but also in terms of ethical norms, practices, behaviors, usually defined biblically in terms of specific behavioral norms with other persons, usually in terms of a genital sexual relationship. If, as I suggest, a primary theological characteristic of human sexuality is the human value of self-worth of being man or woman, so also there is the biblical norm, never use sexual behavior as a way of devaluing human beings. It corresponds to the theological sense of creation of God's gracious gift. Therefore, never devalue human beings. The kind of reflections that take place biblically regarding, for instance, divorce are always reflections which seem some way to do with either devaluing or debasing a human being's worth. And since marriage, as conceived in biblical models, was not imaginable as parity, in other words, since a man took a wife and a man disposed of a wife, therefore divorce is forbidden, because you cannot divorce someone in such a way that they are therefore devalued. To divorce is to devalue. And there's a host of other biblical kind of references where sexual behaviors are forbidden which devalue the worth of human beings. just as sexuality is defined in terms of relational intensity, of intimacy, so also the ethical command is never falsify intimacy. Never falsify intimacy. Never proclaim or affirm to another human being bonds of love and of commitment, bonds which are a lie or a deceit. Just as sexuality is also defined in terms theologically of its power of procreation, so also never use genital sexuality apart from the relationship of personal commitment. It is here that we've gotten into a vast array in recent decades of ethical reflections about non-reproductive genital behavior, i.e. birth control, abortion, homosexuality, etc., etc. We don't know quite what to do with them. And there are all kinds of reflections and certainly debates on those subjects, particularly coming out of Catholic circles. I'd like to move into a different, somewhat different approach to sexuality than either of these two, theological or ethical. And I want to distinguish this from the ethical because of the way it's biblically treated. And I'll give a couple of examples. Ethical reflections on sexuality usually come from the standpoint of a commandment or a moral lesson. This is what you must not do. This is what you should not do. The kind of sexual behavior or reflections that I'm going to talk usually come as a blatant statement with very little reflection except a kind of an awesome symbolic silence. And that is where sexuality is violence. The connection between sexuality and violence. In our culture, and in the problems which I have reflected so much on in both counseling and other pastoral capacities, the primary issue with which I am concerned is sexual abuse, sexual harassment, and sexual violence. In our culture, to be sexual in the mind of many is to be violent. Sexuality, culturally, has become violence. Abuse is virtually equivalent to sexuality. We even speak of the rape of the earth. It's been suggested, I was listening to a theologian from the GTU a couple weeks ago, and he was lecturing in Seattle, and he was dividing up the decades of our century into three decade batches, that the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, the primary concern was civil rights and human justice. The primary concern of the 30s, 40s, and 50s was issues of labor and of equity and of freedom. And the primary concern, says he, of the 90s and the two decades which follow are going to be issues of abuse and violence. Whether we face them from the standpoint of the nuclear possibilities of Holocaust or from the standpoint of Tiananmen Square or from the standpoint of the ecological crisis, the next 30 years, the language we will be speaking is a language of violence and abuse. Maybe he's right. Yeah. Thank you.
Can you give an example or something about your statement that sexuality is violence? I'm having a little trouble connecting that to something.
In many of the postures of sexuality in our culture, sexuality, the expression of one's sexuality, is something one does to somebody else, usually from a posture of power.
Wouldn't the whole stereotypical Latino macho fit into that whole process and being carried over into the general culture?
Yep. Right.
Are you referring perhaps to the soap operas where everybody sleeps around?
Yep.
Kind of a thing?
Yeah. Certainly the promiscuity. Each other. Yep. People, basically, that's a good term. Basically, it's an understanding of people using one another. But I would broaden it not just in terms of genital sexual behavior, intercourse. I'm broadening it to talk about the way in which we posture ourselves. The theme of this of men in relationship to women and of power in relationship to the powerless.
Maybe my concern was, to me, violence maybe isn't the same thing as this. This is what you're saying.
Say more.
Well, you said that it's violence because it's something you do to someone else to show power. And that can be, to me, that can be a word, a line of reasoning, and by which I come out the victor and I win my point, but I don't necessarily consider that violence. Would you call that, to me, violence is a physical act of force that harms another person.
Mm-hmm. No, I think violence is, I'm using it much more broadly. I think violence is anything that violates another person. Violence is known not by the act, but by the effect it has on the other human being. Violence is known not by any specific act of bashing somebody or raping somebody. Violence is known by the person who feels like they've been beaten or taken advantage of. And in all of these 3 days, what I'm going to try to do is enter the whole discussion of human sexuality not from the posture of the disinterested third party who's describing it, but to attempt to enter discussion of human sexuality from the posture of the person who has been abused by it. So that violence is not defined by the act somebody commits. It's defined by the result of its victim, on its victim. Yo.
This means that the subjective state is the final determiner of the reality of whatever has occurred.
This means that the individual person's experience is the determiner. I don't know whether we want to make a distinction between the subjective state, because usually the subjective state of a person who's been violated, that person can also clearly identify objective ways by which that violation was done.
So which has priority, the subjective state or the objective identification of the violent act?
Gorsh, I don't know.
Reality has to be established at some point, or the individual can't be sure of the reality they face.
Let me return to that, can I? Because I'm going to do a thing on levels of violence in a little while, and then pick that one up in that context, if you don't mind.
violence does not have to be physical.
No, violence does not have to be physical. As a matter of fact, most violence is psychological and therefore subjective. But I don't want to suggest that because it is psychological, it is not also objective. Right. Now, the postures of the church, the postures of the pastor in relating to the enormity of the human situation of sexual violence, intimidation, harassment, and abuse, I think, I will suggest over and over again probably, are threefold. Number one, we've got to stop the violence. Number two, we've got to heal, we've got to save shalom, the victim. And number three, for those of us who are male clergy, we must know our own participation in the violence of our culture. In other words, we must know our own sexuality as potentially violent.
Including intimidation.
Including all kinds of things. Again, we'll have a list. Now, to do this, again, we have to see sexuality not just from the theological perspective or from an ethical perspective where we begin to discuss norms and rules. We have to see violence, or if we have to see sexual violence, harassment, abuse, etc., from the perspective of the person who is being violated. And that is usually women and children, but also it is men. Because, as countless reflections on the nature of the male animal are being written in our decade, they indicate that fragile, lonely, angry, frustrated, highly vulnerable condition in which men competitively or whatever are violating anybody and everybody around. Having said that much, half hour introduction here, are any other thoughts, any other reflections, questions? I'd like to
focus I need to get in terms of, I really hear you saying that violating is done by men but not by women.
No. I think violating is done primarily by those who have power. Violence is primarily done as from a posture of power. It's done by a posture of power to a posture of weakness. Not men are not the only occupants of postures of power. But in our culture, obviously, that's where most of it is.
It seems to me, though, that most violence in our culture is done by people who don't have power. Physical violence.
I'm sorry? Physical violence?
It seems to me a lot of physical violence in our culture is done by people who don't have any power, who are struggling to assert their lack of power.
Quite often that's so. I think that's especially true where you have persons who are really marginal economically or socially, who can become very violent. I'm not sure that their method of violence is entirely more violent than those who do hold power and may do violence in more socially acceptable ways.
It seems to me that you're saying, or
at least I believe that when you use power, you automatically are violating somebody. And that was not the way of Christ. Mm-hmm. He made himself weak and powerless, and he was violated by others. But he gladly assumed that rather than use power against them. Mm-hmm. Now, one exception to that might be when he cleansed the temple. I haven't evaluated that. But then the use of power would be, in other words, would be the opposite of agape.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we all use power, right?
Yeah. And just the way in which we define the act of the sexual act, it culturally it's usually defined in terms of some act of power. I feel great, I feel manly, I feel powered. In fact, in terms of deepest moments of intimacy, the sexual act is usually a moment of great vulnerability and abandonment of self.
Just, this may sound really stupid, but just define power, because I think it gets at the issue back here. Does power have anything to do with economics, or is that just one expression of power? So maybe we need to define what we're talking about when we mean power.
Well, let me just define very, very, very situationally in terms of the context of a pastor. I think the minute a person assumes a pastoral office, he assumes an office which is symbolically endowed with power. The question isn't whether that pastor has power. The question is whether that power is used to abuse or whether it is used to proclaim. So I'm not suggesting that all power is categorically bad. The example of Christ tends cleansing the temple. The example of Christ assuming postures in the sermons on the mountain of the plain. There's all kinds of examples of power which are enormously salvific biblically. But where power begins, where a person in a posture of power uses that power in such a way that another human being is devalued or violated. That's what we're talking about.
I understand what you're saying with that, but what is power? When you get down to just the definition as we're using it here in context and relational context, what is power?
Parents have power over children.
Children have power over parents.
Yeah.
So it's the ability to control.
We have one of the greatest devaluers at our use, given to us by God, and that is the preaching of the law to devalue people. To devalue them the way that they have valued themselves. They bring the power of the gospel. So I don't know if I would say that all power to devalues is such a bad thing, because some people need to hear that in the case of theology and the preaching of the law.
I would understand law as a means of grace, and therefore as something which does not devalue me.
But the law is not a means of grace, because it does not. We do not receive forgiveness through the law proper. It brings guilt and it brings condemnation. It's the gospel which brings the forgiveness.
The law.
That's the way I understand it.
The law is a mirror, not a devalue. It just reflects accurately what they are, not devalue.
What about Psalm 51, let the bones you have crushed, by the law.
But God is the one showing us our real value, that we are but dust. And it's not a devaluing of us. Where we misuse the law, we devalue someone.
It's a revaluing.
I would say it's a new value. If we are dust, the new value comes in the gospel, where you are declared to be a child of God.
It seems to me that the law does not devalue people. The intent of the law never was something like that. The intent of the law is to show you what God made you to be. And because we're not that way, then it has a negative effect. We feel condemned by it because we see we aren't what God intended us to be. So it has a positive value.
When you use the law when you should be using the gospel, I would say that would be the point where you devalue.
Yeah.
That's abuse.
That would be.
Well, that's the point, is that would bring a person, you know, make him feel less valuable than what he is. Mm-hmm. If he needs to, you know, if he's already crushed and he wants to hear, or is ready to hear the gospel, ready to believe the gospel, and you continue to give him law, then I think that would devalue the person. Mm-hmm. That's just in addition to what all has been said.
Over there, the man who was asking, what's power? And I mentioned that parents have power over children. Parents are in a position of power to say, you will do this, you will not do that. And if some, and I decide you have done something terrible, you will be spanked. Or I decide you will go to your room for doing this or doing that. And the kid isn't going to say, Mom, you have to go to your room. But I, as a parent, can say, you're going to spend 5 minutes in the little bathroom because you didn't listen to me. And that's power. I mean, it's inherent in
that you're saying it's control. The ability I have to control you, or you give me the power to control you. But then it seems to me that what I keep hearing from people is that the issue of power is the issue of control, which transcends a lot of things that you can see on the surface in any kind of relationship where if people don't have anything, it still can be a control issue.
May I suggest we do some small, break into some small groups for a minute, or like for maybe 15 minutes. What I'd like to have you reflect upon is your own childhood or teenage, when we were growing up and when we entered the various kinds of fraternities. When did you, in your memory, when did you ever witness sexual abuse, violence, or abuse of sexual power? How did it feel? What were your feelings when you were, as you reflect on your first memory of sexuality becoming an abusive power? And what did you do about it? Could you break up into groups of three and spend, say, 15 minutes on that? What kind of memories do you have of this? Most of us saw it as very young children in one way or another. Whether with the kids on the block or in our own experience. Find a couple people around you.
I feel like I'm being violated.
You are.
Sexual abuse about that. I need a really sexual object.
not sure how much
Let's reconstitute ourselves and maybe share a couple of these reflections, if you will. What do you do?
Well, you read the gospel.
What?
You got that one?
Can we kind of share something? Anyone like to share a story from their memories? When did you first experience, when did you first become a witness?
How did I phrase the question?
When did you first know something about this thing that violates people? Anyone have a memory they'd like to share that's pertinent to where we are? Does everybody have such a memory?
Sixth grade in the locker room.
Sixth grade in the locker room?
Talking, you know, some of the boys talking about others while they're showering or whatever.
Yep.
Not the same, that kind of violence. Mm-hmm.
Locker room talk is legendarily violent.
Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Junior high, alternating gym days, and how a certain girl one day would be rather endowed and another day not be. Mm-hmm. And when she was endowed, naturally she didn't have gym, and it was our turn. And mm-hmm. ridiculing her that way.
The stories of sexual conquest that used to come back from people coming home late at night during college. And they were usually phrased that way. Stories told by friends of ours when we were children about being beaten, going home and getting lickings, being afraid, friends of ours as children. Do you remember friends of yours as children who were afraid to go home?
I remember there was some guys in the neighborhood who used to tell these incredibly violent sexual jokes that involved castration. And I remember them being so vivid in the way they told, they were always the older guys, the sixth graders or something. I must have been third or fourth, but they were so vivid in their descriptions that there was almost a sort of a technicolor presentation of these. And I always wondered, they didn't see fight in me, but they seemed incredibly funny to these other guys. Like, well, they're so violent. I remember hearing that, thinking, well, why, what is funny about this? But it was a very violent scene.
Will?
Well, sometimes it's not even the immediate reaction, but it's the internalization and subliminous sticking them underneath and burying them away and maybe living with them for 50 years before you realize what really happened.
Yes. 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 And I think that's a really good point. So much of what was violent we knew about, but it didn't register. My 80-year-old mother was at our home about a year ago. Marie Fortune's book, Is Nothing Sacred, describes a case of a pastoral sexual abuser. She picked up the book, read the book, and her response to a bit to me was, you know, I never did like Pastor so-and-so, a pastor whom I remember was our pastor 45 years ago. But no one ever spoke of it for what it was. She heard the stories about abuse. So much was not named. So much was never named. Yeah, Phil?
Reflecting on this change of subject from that, you know, I up until this moment never really thought of it as sexual abuse. It's the extreme cruelty that we have towards each other, you know, that girl with that boy. But the terms are, that we use are very such ugly. You know, 100 names attached to this. It attacks at the point of one's vulnerability, which is the sexual.
And what do boys call boys who do not have macho athletic prowess and ability? Sissy, wimp, fag, etc., etc., etc. It is. That's really true. Yeah.
I heard a mother, in name only, I suppose, tell a child about 9 years old that you were a mistake. You never should have been born.
That's violent.
Yeah.
That's an assault that's
going to
be awful hard to
get. Now, you see, I would contend that that's sexual violence, because what you've done is you've hit that person at the incredible core of their being.
Yeah.
you're talking about reactions. I'm feeling one right now. Just hearing all this stuff, it's stressful.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say it, but like, kind of like you're torn up inside.
I think one of our reactions culturally and normatively to this kind of understanding of sexuality is fear. You know, this kind of a way of, we back away from it. And I think that's one of the reactions we've had, you know, particularly in the Christian church. And I will be suggesting tomorrow in terms of the pastor's response to persons who are victims of sexual abuse. That the greatest thing we can do is to break that silence which fear and that backing away from has led us into. Yes, Jack?
Would you consider lack of information about sexuality violence?
That's an interesting question. There's those that would. I'm not sure that I would. I think it depends on why the information, you know, what was taking place in the dynamics of the family or of the... Let me give you a context in which I think lack of information could be considered violence. I think one of the major myths about being raised as a male was that somehow or other you had within you some kind of a smoldering, dangerous, rapacious, animal, instinctive, sexual energy, which if it was in any way lit, would destroy you and everybody around you. That males were inherently sexually dangerous. So therefore, the way you kept that danger of being male stifled was to keep them stupid. So we were sometimes deprived of information as we matured about our sexuality as a way of somehow or other curtailing our danger. And I think the same thing may well have been the experience of women, where lack of information about sexuality, in fact, although it may have come across as benign, may have worked on the basis of assumptions about our sexuality, which were ultimately very abusive. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That myth of sexuality, of somehow or other, if we inform people about sexuality, they're going to go out and do something absolutely uncontrollable. That's a very widespread myth. I witnessed the reactions that have come on to your own Concordia series on human sexuality, which is intended for children, to get people just violently reactive to even bringing up the subject with children. Marvelous material. But you know, it's sort of like you might just open something we can't control. Well, you see, if you get that assumption about human sexuality, boy, you've really done something to me that was pretty abusive. That makes sense? Yes. Al?
I think I trust everybody in the room not to share this. There's a picture that keeps popping up in family albums that we have of me as a small child with long locks. I mean, way down beyond the shoulders. And I was born during the war. My father was overseas, and he saw the picture. He cut that kid's hair. He's not a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up, really inclined towards music,
mm-hmm.
A lot of my life has been trying to establish my masculinity. Hence the cars and the carpentry and all those kinds of things to say I'm a man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was violence in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
To dress me as a little girl, almost.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there was nothing in my mother's mind except she liked long locks.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have at least one child with locks.
Can you bring us a picture next time?
No. I work hard to bury that thing.
I'm intrigued. I mean.
It's kind of fascinating. There's two pictures of my brother and myself. The other one is my mother's wedding picture. What she calls her wedding picture, which was the gown she wore to get married and everything. She's holding my brother. And then the one with me in the dress. Both of them get hidden fairly often.
Steve?
Yeah. Isn't another area that we a lot of times just ignore of sexual abuse in the whole
range of advertisements in magazines, television, the whole route. And that becomes a problem with when you're working with someone trying to help them pass this, and these images keep coming to them because they're all over.
It's a very interesting study of contemporary advertisement that shows a man and a woman, maybe it's for shaving cream or some kind of new hairdo or something or other, anything that has to do with personal appearance, and watch the look on their faces, not just their posturing. The look on his face will be a look of power, and the look on her face will be a look of fear. And that's used to sell products. It's just amazing. Watch particularly the woman's face, and you see this. Very often, it's used to sell particularly male grooming products.
Are you going to touch on, in my ministry, there has been an individual who touches persons and so forth. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, let's talk about that tomorrow. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Put off on that one. Look at a couple of biblical texts. The first of which is Genesis 19. Hold me to that one, because we'll talk about that in the context of pastoral care.
19 what?
Yeah, 1 through 8. It's the classic text which is usually used to describe sodomy. Two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, bowed himself with his face to the earth, and said, "My lords, turn aside, I pray you, to your servant's house and spend the night, and wash your feet that you may rise up early and go on your own way." They said, "No, we will spend the night in the street." But he urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house, and they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them." Lot went out of the door to the men, shut the door after them, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known man. Let me bring them out to you to do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof." We usually read that one as a biblical condemnation of homosexuality. More recently read as a statement about hospitality. It may well be a statement about both, but it is a statement primarily about violence. And it is any wonder that Lot's two daughters would later be described as incestuous, temptresses, with a father who would give them away.
They were virgins.
At the expense of guests, yeah.
At the expense of guests. The classic text of terror, as Phyllis Tribble describes it, is a rather long narrative, but I don't think it's all that unusual. You think of Rahab, you think of Sarah, you think of all, particularly these Old Testament texts. There's some fantastic Old Testament texts that we just simply haven't gotten the point of. And this is a long narrative out of Judges 19. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim. Again, listen to how these texts that describe violence, sexuality's connection to violence, listen to how they are laid out for us virtually without moralization or comment. They become like photodramas of incredible impact. When Abraham gives Sarah, his wife, to Pharaoh, passes her off as his sister. When Rahab is kicked out into the desert to starve, they're texts which are just given as a drama that produces so much horror that you just can't do anything but just sit in Hagar. Yeah. Those days there, when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah, and his concubine became angry with him, and she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there some 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. He had with him his servant and a couple of asses, and he came to her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. And his father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay, and he remained with him 3 days, so they ate and drank and lodged there. And on the fourth day they arose early in the morning, and he prepared to go, but the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go." So the two men sat and ate and drank together, and the girl's father said to the men, "Sounds like a great convivial group. Be pleased to spend the night and let your heart be merry." And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law urged him till he lodged there again. And on the fifth day he rose early in the morning to depart. And the girl's father said, "Strengthen your heart and tarry until the day decline." So they ate, both of them. And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold, now the day has waned toward evening. Pray tarry all night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here and let your heart be merry, and tomorrow you shall arise early in the morning for your journey and go home." But the man would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. He had with him a couple of saddled asses, and his concubine was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was far spent, and the servant said to his master, "Come now, let us turn aside to this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." And his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah." And he said to his servant, "Come and let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah." So they passed on and went their way. And the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no man took them into his house to spend the night. Now the whole purpose of this is, this is a convivial gathering of the old boys club, basically. "And behold, an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was a sojourner at Gibeah. The men of the place were Benjaminites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the wayfarer in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going, and whence do you come?' And he said to him, 'We are passing from Bethlehem to Judah, in Judah, to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, from which I came. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to my home, and nobody takes me into his house. We have straw and provender for our asses, with bread and wine for me and your maidservants and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything.' The old man said, 'Peace be to you. I will care for all your wants, only do not spend the night in the square.' So he brought them into his house and gave the asses provender, and they washed their feet and ate great hospitality. As they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, base fellows, beset the house round about, beating on the door, and they said to the old man, the master of the house, 'Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him.'" Sounds familiar. "And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my brethren, do not act so wickedly, seeing that this man has come into my house. Do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now, ravish them, and do with them what seems good to you, but against this man do not do so vile a thing. But the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine, put her out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night until the morning, and as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house, where her master was, till it was light. And her master rose up in the morning. When he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up, let us be going." But there was no answer. Then he put her upon the ass, and the man rose up and went away to his home. And when he entered his house, he took the knife, and laying hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, "Such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt unto this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak." Phyllis Trible identifies that as one of the great texts of terror, the unnamed woman of Judges, she calls it. Now, the New Testament's treatment of violence is interesting, and particularly in Matthew and in Luke. And I'm not going to go into. You've got the woman being stoned. Jesus intercepts. Usually, there's an effort on behalf of the crowd to dismiss or devalue or debase her. Jesus usually turns it around and revalues her. By the law, to use that language. You have also the debasement of and putting down of children. Get away, kids. Let the little children, for of such is. You have the Syrophoenician woman. You have the widow's pence. The formula in all of them is the same. The crowds want to debase them. Jesus accepts them and puts down the crowns. I'm aware that it's 20 minutes. We'll get into the levels of violence tomorrow morning. Let me just kind of close with some assumptions that I'm wanting to make. I think it is necessary for us in the church, particularly those of us who occupy a pastoral office, to earnestly wrestle with what is evil. The Augustinian answer was that evil is concupiscence and lust, sexually defined. Even the Tillichian answer of contemporary theology is that evil has to do with alienation and separation between persons. Also, strangely enough, often sexually defined. I think we must work with the reality that evil is that which violates human beings, and that evil is a real and demonic power, and that it is pervasive, and that it is universal. The Augustinian definition of sexuality made sexuality as evil, as lust, as a, if you will, subjective. It has to do with feelings I have. But feelings I have are nothing compared to violence and abuse and harassment. Nor is evil simply separation. I note this a notion of evil from a person who many of you may know, a man who has opened to me in the last couple of years the Old Testament. He's now deceased. He died last year. Carl Gresser. Any of you have him as a professor?
I
He's the one that says Old Testament concept of evil is violence. The essence of evil in the Old Testament is violence. That's a powerful, powerful insight to me. Secondly, that violence is whatever is done by the abuse of those in postures of power. And we must redefine sexuality not just in terms of power, even rightly considered, but also in terms of vulnerability and weakness. That sexuality has to do with gentleness. It has to do with a sense of ourselves as men, if you will, who are gentle, vulnerable human beings. Thirdly, that the sense of power in our culture is primarily defined sexually. I don't care whether you're talking about world nuclear power, economic power, systemic power, the winners always screw the losers. And the language of power, the way it is done in our world, provides a comprehensive idiom which is expressed in the language of sexuality. Fourthly, that although that is comprehensive and universal, sexual violence is primarily a male problem. And it arises out of the context of what has happened to men in our world. Whether it be the anger or the loneliness or the sense of depersonalization or the role expectations, the weights and burnouts and problems we bear that cause us to die a lot earlier and exhibit all kinds of other diseases, men, somehow or other, in our culture, are both the perpetrators and the victims of a society which has associated maleness with abuse. And finally, and I'll close there so we can have 10 minutes off, the greatest problem facing the church regarding human sexuality is silence itself. Because silence has allowed sexuality to become violent. We'll pick that theme up tomorrow morning. I want to talk about pastoral care and pastoral issues, if you will, not just pastoral care, regarding the reality of sexuality as violence. And I want to then on Tuesday morning, I guess, specifically address issues of the pastor as a sexual person.
Today is Tuesday.
Thursday. Pardon me, Thursday.
He's going to have 3 Mondays this week, so he's going to stay on Thursday.